When Peter Carey published his first novel, Bliss, back in 1981, he was seen as a bright new talent and a deserving winner of that year's Miles Franklin Award. Since then, he's gone on to win the Booker Prize twice and he's published more than 10 novels. Bliss was adapted as a feature film in 1985 and now, in what's rare for an Australian novel, it's being turned into an opera. One of our leading musicians and composers, Brett Dean, has been working on the project for more than 10 years. Bliss is about the life and many deaths of Harry Joy. Harry is a successful advertising executive who suffers a heart attack at the start of the novel. Although he's revived, Harry believes he's dead and in hell, where actors are playing members of his dysfunctional family. It's a strange and dark novel that ends with Harry's real death 30-something years later in a commune off Bog Onion Road. So how do you stage this highly episodic text and turn it into words that can be sung in opera? Amanda Holden has written the libretto for Bliss, as well as writing words and translations for opera and theatre. She's the editor of the New Penguin Opera Guide. And Amanda Holden, she joins us now. Welcome to the Book Show.
Thank you.
Now, Amanda, when you were approached to write the libretto, I believe you hadn't read Bliss, although you knew Peter Carey's writing. How did you work out whether to accept the project?
Well, it was such an exciting project that I think I would have been an idiot to refuse it. But of course, if I thought that I couldn't do it, I would have had to turn it down. I didn't know the novel. I had read the short stories and also Oscar and Lucinda. So I was very eager to read the novel. And I have to say, when I first read it, I thought, my goodness, this is going to be very difficult.
Why? What presented itself as difficulties?
I think it's a very complex novel because Peter Carey has a real sort of pell-mell style of imagery, which goes very fast. And also, somehow his writing didn't really, to me, seem musical. Now, that's not really a criticism. It's just that he writes words on a page, and I have to write words that are going to be heard, clearly, hopefully, and that singers have to sing. So I really couldn't do anything except start from scratch and kind of distill the novel down to a shape and then rebuild it for the stage. We don't have quite as many deaths in our opera as there are in the novel, and the ending isn't quite the same. It doesn't end 30 years later. It ends with the resolution for Harry Joy. He actually manages to escape his hellish state. But it's quite possible that there is a slight question mark over the very end, which doesn't really matter.
It was interesting to hear you say that the words weren't very musical, that Peter Carey had written. What do you mean by that? I mean, you know, I suppose at one level, if things rhyme together, they could be thought of as musical. But how do you mean? Are there certain kinds of words that are easier to sing than others?
Yes, definitely. I think I'm very fortunate that I can write words for singers, but I really fear that I wouldn't be able to if I hadn't worked in music all my life, and my training is as a musician. I started out as an accompanist and I worked a lot with singers, and I'm very happy that I did now. I don't think very many novels are actually musical, and if you were to look through the pantheon of librettists, actually I don't think there is such a thing, I don't think I can call it a pantheon. I think we librettists are actually hacks, because we have to provide a liaison between the original literary text and the composer. Now, when it's a play, possibly the actual transference from the page or the original to the opera stage is a bit more obvious. But with a novel, it's different. I think perhaps one of my predecessors in England writing librettos, Mifanwy Piper, is a very good example, because she adapted The Turn of the Screw from the Henry James and also Death in Venice from the Thomas Mann. She did both those for Benjamin Britten, and it's been very salutary to me, actually, to read those and to try and see what she did.
And what she missed out and what she beefed up.
Yes, I suppose so. I mean, I don't feel that I write in a particular style of my own. I've done a few librettos. Obviously, invitations to write a libretto don't come very thick and fast. But I feel whenever I do write one that I'm really trying to carry on a tradition which goes back 400 years. And it's a tradition that I know snippets of because I've actually translated about 50 of those librettos for the stage.
Mm.
It's something about the activeness of the words. I think words to hear are so different to words to read. Also, the libretto of Bliss is just under 9,000 words. And, well, I haven't counted the number of words in the novel.
It would be more than that.
I guess there are probably upwards of 90,000 more, probably. So, in fact, it really is a condensation and then a rebuilding using very, very pithy kind of words, or the right words for the right emotional or action situation. It was very interesting for me to get to know Brett and to get to know his music a bit. And we, in a way, he was my guide while I was writing the libretto. We met every so often when we could. I mean, it was a little tricky because he was mostly in Melbourne and I was mostly in London. But we did manage to meet in Europe when he came over to play his viola, which is one of the many things he does so brilliantly. And so whenever I'd done a chunk, we would discuss it very closely. And that meant not just discussing the language, but also discussing the characters and what they were up to and whether they needed perhaps a little aria, and then who they were going to be in dialogue with and what was going to happen next. It wasn't actually really, retrospectively, I see now that it was a most brilliant choice for an opera because of the colourfulness of the novel. It's the journey of an everyman figure, and on his journey he encounters so many various situations, from the sublime to the ridiculous and the horrific. This isn't an opera that you're going to come out with a big smile on your face saying that was fun. I think it's quite a tough evening, but it certainly is going to be a very entertaining one.
I wanted to talk to you a little bit more about your collaboration with Brett Dean and how it actually worked, but I noticed you've written poems for this opera. and that's unusual for you, isn't it?
It is, actually. I was quite surprised myself. But what happened was that Sir Simon Rattle actually commissioned Brett to write a piece for a concert he was giving in Liverpool in 2008. And I was working in 2007 on the libretto. I did it that year. And Brett received the commission from Simon Rattle and he said, oh, goodness me, I've got to write a piece. I'd like to do some songs from Bliss. And so that's how we wrote the three songs for Harry Joy. They're called, not surprisingly, Songs of Joy. And they kind of came out of the writing process. And it was really quite a challenge for me. The first one is very much based on Harry's various accounts of his heart attack and what he felt. So they are quite sort of Carey-esque. But the other two, well, the second one is called The Ballad of Little Titch, and it's a sort of pattery, almost sort of W.S. Gilbert-type poem, a story which Harry tells to the police officers when he's been arrested to try and get himself out of the police station. And the third one comes at the very, very end of the opera, and for this I actually wrote a sonnet, and it was really a sort of challenge to myself, but it was fun. No, I don't think of myself as a poet, but I suppose when I get very old and I've got no librettos to write, I suppose I could try writing poetry.
So how do you shape it on the page? I mean, I'm just trying to imagine, because I read the libretto and then, of course, I didn't have the music, so I had no idea what it was going to sound like. But what is the relationship between the music and the words? I mean, when you talk meeting Brett Dean and you talked about whether somebody needed a soliloquy or something like that, but where is the music and when you sit down and work out what the words are going to be?
That's really quite a difficult question to answer, but if I briefly tell you about the opening of the opera, it might perhaps illustrate how I did it. I think I did it by knowing what had to happen. So, unlike the book, the opera is going to open with a chorus. It was actually Richard Hickox, the former now late, sadly, director of Opera Australia, who said he wanted full chorus in this opera. And it seemed a good idea to let them set the ball rolling. So we open on a party celebrating Harry's 20 successful years as managing director of his company. And it's during this party, at the end of it, that he has a heart attack. And so the opera opens with his friend calling for a toast, making a little speech, the chorus swinging into a cheerful chorus. And then at the height of the celebrations, the music becomes really ratcheted up with lots of heartbeats going doolally, and Harry falls over. Then, of course, the music has to change. And I actually suggested to Brett that it might be a moment for some stillness, for some shock from the family. And I suggested that he might write a quintet. And so the wife.
And why is a quintet the right thing to reach for in your shelf of things to do?
Well, I don't know if it is, or she'll find out when I see it on the stage. But there was a quintet that I knew about in The Barber of Seville. It's a kind of quintet of shock when all the characters actually sing more or less the same words in counterpoint. And the music is shocked and different to what came before. And it somehow seemed the right thing to illustrate that moment. And during this quintet, which kind of gathers in horror and alarm, the body of Harry is taken away on the revolving stage and placed in a hospital bed already straight in for the next scene, which is entirely different. We see him in the hospital bed, and two nurses are gossiping about him. He's apparently moribund, but we know he's alive. So, in fact, from the start, the opening speech and the opening chorus suggest the music, and then Brett writes it, sets the words. So, in fact, the words come first.
Yeah, well, that's really interesting, because it's very often that the librettist's name is forgotten over time. We know the composer, but not who wrote the libretto. And given you've described the libretto actually, starting the whole thing off, is it a creative injustice?
Well, I don't feel that. I mean, if you think of The Marriage of Figaro, you don't think it's by Mozart and Da Ponte. I mean,
but why
a
not?
Lot of people... Well, because the operas are by composers, and the librettists are the people who are actually there to write the skeletons for them. I think the best composers have always been quite hands-on about words. I would dearly love to see Mifanwy Piper's sketches for her Britten operas. I think he was very particular about words. So was Puccini, so was Verdi, so was Mozart. And it has been a joy to work with Brett, because it has been quite a ding-dong. And though the full libretto was sketched before he actually added the music, he was ready with the music. He had been thinking about the project for much, much longer than I had. And so we had been kind of working on it together for a year or so, and it was a kind of collaboration. And I was hopefully just writing the kind of words that he would want to set.
Well, you, of course, are a musician too. You're a pianist, and you came to writing through music. Does that make you a particular kind of librettist?
I don't know. I think it might do. It's what is quite useful is if some of the words don't work when you hear them sung, I can actually rewrite them and still fit them to the same bit of music.
Mm.
I've done a little bit of that. And I just love being in the rehearsal room. It's the next big stage. You know, after the loneliness of writing the libretto, then the tweaking it and workshopping it and little rewrites and so on with Brett to suit the music, and then in the rehearsal room this afternoon I'm going to hear the first orchestral rehearsal, which I'm extremely excited about, because I think Brett has got a phenomenal orchestral palette at his disposal.
Well, you mentioned before you've translated a number of operas from the original Italian, French and German. Does that mean that you speak those languages?
Well, I can get myself round and about in those countries, but I'm not fluent speaker at all. I think I'm probably a fluent understander of old French Italian and German. I mean, I know what Wagnerian German is like, and I know what kind of Italian Donizetti set. And I know Bizet's Carmen and his, also his Pearl Fishers and even his Jolie Fille de Perth. So that's the kind of linguist I am. I've always studied languages, but you don't need to speak or to write languages in order to understand foreign opera librettos.
And to choose the right way to express it in English.
I think all a translator can do is to kind of somersault the language into your own and try to preserve the flavour of the original. When I began translating Handel, I've done the last four Handel productions at English National Opera, I was really quite daunted, partly because there are very few words, and they're usually rather serious, and so the vocabulary is quite small. But I found that actually by reading 18th century poetry, I could get myself into the sort of Handelian mode and try to reproduce that kind of language, bearing in mind that it was my kind of audience was going to listen to it.
Mm. Amanda Holden, one of the comments that's often made about contemporary opera is that the words are often hard to hear or distinguish. What do you think, and how much does that matter?
I think audiences are quite greedy these days. I think they feel if they're not hearing every single word, they're not getting their money's worth, and perhaps they need to read them if they didn't hear them. I come from a very old-fashioned attitude to opera. When I first went to opera in the 50s and 60s in England, actually, it was all in English, so I didn't really have to worry about understanding the words. Glyndebourne was the only company that performed opera in the original in those days. But it is true that you won't hear every word when you go to the opera, and it is true that it doesn't matter, because I think if you listen carefully, you'll hear the words that matter. And how can you hear every word if it's a quintet? You're not going to hear all the words, particularly if the protagonists have different texts to sing, and are coming at a situation from a different point of view, which of course they are. And I feel that it's the music that is leading the drama, and I think that's something that people perhaps don't realise. It's almost a psychological thing. And what moves us in Madame Butterfly, for example, the love duet, great big famous love duet at the end of Act One, is really nothing to do with the text. Because in fact he is saying, oh, you're so beautiful, let's go to bed. And she is saying, aren't the stars lovely, aren't the stars lovely, because she's 15 and terrified. She's just got married to this American. And you never hear the words, but everybody adores the duet because the music is so beautiful.
Well,
I think that's a good example, actually. And so as long as you know what's going on and you can follow enough words, it should be okay.
We spoke about your relationship with Brett Dean, who's writing the music, but what about the singers? When you meet the singers and they go through things, does that affect the libretto?
No, not unless it's obviously something that the music has made the words very difficult to go over, in which case it's possible to either change the music or maybe the word. It doesn't. What is fantastic, I love getting to know the singers and actually working with them, because it's fascinating, because after all, they are bringing the notes and the words off the page and into life. I feel that it's quite a challenge for singers to sing words. I think singing in English is really quite difficult. Possibly singing in Italian, for example, might come more easily.
Because there's not as many natural rhymes in English.
No, that's not the case, really. I mean, I do write rhyming song like Ariosos and those kind of things when I think the music needs a kind of rhythm to urge it along. And in translating, I know that most composers do actually have rhymes. They do like setting librettos with rhymes. And so rhyming is a very important energy-giving device. But for female singers, I think it's much harder to get the words over across the auditorium than it is for men. It's as simple as that. Baritones can do it easily. Tenors can quite often manage it, the low female voices are sometimes clearer than the high ones, and you will never have a clue what the Queen of the Night is saying, singing, will you? Because it's just too high. It's all to do with the what you can hear, really.
So it's physics.
I suppose it is. I don't know very much about physics, but I know that you can't hear a very high female voice. And also, if they're going to be singing very high, it's a very good idea to give them open vowels.
One thing, of course, with all of this research and reading and listening, did you have a conversation with Peter Carey?
No, I never did. Alas, it's a real shame, because about two or three weeks ago, he was in London with his new book, and I sadly couldn't go and meet him. And the same thing happened 2 years ago. I was in Melbourne when he was in London, so I haven't met him at all. Brett actually has got to know him quite well, as you said at the beginning, but no, I haven't met him.
I think he spoke to one of the programs here, the 7:30 Report, and he said, someone was asking whether he was going to have anything to do with this project, and he said, no, it would be ridiculous for me to try to control or affect anything. My work's already done, and somebody has taken the pot that I made and, with my great encouragement, smashed it up into powder again and rebuilt something else from that clay. That's exciting, so it's not about me. So that's good.
Well, that's very, very nice of him. I think it is about him, because he is the inspiration for the whole piece. I don't know of a librettist actually ever meeting a source writer. I don't think it really is something that has to happen.
Mm.
And maybe, as you said also, not a great many librettos are written on novels by living writers. That's something that is very unusual. I did set a play by Sean O'Casey for a composer in England, and I did get to meet Sean O'Casey's widow shortly before she died, and I also met O'Casey's daughter, and that was really very thrilling. But I don't feel that I actually need to meet Peter Carey for this project, though, of course, I would have loved to.
Well, Amanda Holden, thank you so much for being on the Book Show today.